That's a good metaphor, and it fits perfectly. That's right. Of the seven components of the Supreme Court, when there's an alteration of any one part of it, it does change the chemistry. It changes the attitude of all the players, depending upon the style, the energy, the scholarship of the newcomer. And it is a new entity any time one component is altered. Well, the Michigan Supreme Court was suffering, if that's the verb, an alteration of one or two components at least annually for a period there, and the court was in a condition of considerable upset. But as to this notion of collegiality, without making too much of it, I think it's important to understand that a court of second appellate review, like the Michigan Supreme Court, has a number of functions to perform beside, in addition to, deciding cases and writing opinions. It also has this constitutional duty to superintend the whole of the state judiciary and the practice of law, to oversee the disciplinary process for lawyers and for judges, the budgetary responsibility it has with respect to its own court, the Supreme Court, but the lower courts as well. And these non-decisional responsibilities, as I'll call them, require, if the court is to be effective, efficient, and to be respected as an administrative unit, as it were, a solidarity and a unity of action on the part of the justices. There can't be any divisive backbiting or personal or enmities of any kind that surface, at least, or that interfere with that work. And so, in respect of those non-decisional duties, rulemaking as well, it was critical, it seemed to me, that the court have speak as one voice and have a collegial, unitary understanding of the kind of judiciary we want to have in Michigan. The education of the judges is another component of that. However, when that hat is removed, the court turns to its responsibilities of deciding cases, something different happens. As I said yesterday, the primary function of a court of second appellate review, like our Supreme Court in Michigan, I'm not sure I want to use the word primary, but among the primary decisional functions is the development of the common law. The others, as I said, are to construe the meaning of new statutory enactments, the meaning of constitutional provisions, both state and federal, which have not been explored before, and occasionally giving advisory opinions under the Michigan Constitution. But principally, I think, it is to do this interstitial lawmaking, this business of appropriate judicial lawmaking. Now, to do that effectively, a member of the court has to have a comprehensive and a coherent philosophy of the judicial, of the proper judicial function. The knee-jerk labels for those are conservatives often are said to be people who are opposed to judicial lawmaking and simply want to apply the law the legislature enacts and not make law. That's been a popular idiom politically in the last decade. It is said, on the other hand, that judicial liberals in the judiciary, it is said, feel that the Constitution is a living document and that statutes must and that it and that statutes must be construed with respect to the best interests of the people at the time, given the facts, that it's all kind of elastic and the judges should do equity. The Michigan Supreme Court is essentially a political body, despite the fact that the justices don't take any oath to uphold any political philosophy and, in fact, take one to uphold the Constitution and the statutes. The truth of the matter is, every member of the Supreme Court got there because of the political process. And while during my tenure, I never detected, to my utter surprise, I never detected any party loyalty in any of the justices. There was, I think, in everybody, a philosophical disposition about the judicial function, which is consistent with the general liberal perspective, or generally the conservative perspective. So here we are, the seven of us, in the morning during the administrative conference, trying to speak as one voice with respect to the superintendents of the bar and the profession and rulemaking and budgetary matters and disciplinary matters. And then in the afternoon session, we are engaged very often in this judicial lawmaking function, part of which requires the understanding that the court should not then necessarily strive to speak with one voice. After all, one of the reasons there are seven people on the Supreme Court is to bring to bear on these difficult questions of often, usually, first impression, the perspective of seven different people, the scholarship of seven different people. Otherwise, we'd only need one, as Tom Kavanaugh has often said. And so it's altogether appropriate in the decisional process for a member of the court to ask himself or herself whether the proper resolution of this constitutional question or this statutory interpretation is necessarily what the majority around the table think. Now, to do that properly, you can't approach a question by saying, I think I'll be a conservative today about this, or I think I'll be a liberal. I think one needs to have to be able to bring to bear, as I said earlier, a coherent philosophy of judicial lawmaking. And when people get to the Supreme Court by the happenstance of an election or the happenstance of a gubernatorial appointment, they don't necessarily come with a background of scholarship and reflection about developing that kind of a coherent philosophy. And that's why, in large measure, I think it takes two or three or four or five years to learn the job. So, the collegial decision process has to be one in which everyone recognizes that it's altogether appropriate for different philosophical perspectives to be brought to bear in deciding this case. And when a majority is struck and is evident, the majority decides the case, and that's the decision. And the minority needs to express, has a constitutional duty to express its disagreement in writing through the dissents. Now, there had been a history in the Supreme Court of very vitriolic dissent writing, sometimes highly personalized and sometimes even belittling of the other justices. And I never understood how that could be until I got there. When I got there, I understood how I could see that the correct answer for me to a question of first impression was so clear and so self-evident that it was almost incomprehensible to me how the others could see it differently. As I got older in the job, there were less and less, fewer and fewer of those occasions when the other point of view was incomprehensible to me. And so I tried during my tenure, and didn't always succeed, by the way. I tried during my tenure, when I was writing in dissent, to remember that these are seven reasonable people around the table, and the fact that the majority, in my judgment, is dead wrong doesn't mean they're dumb. And it doesn't mean they're ignorant. It doesn't mean they're craven. And it doesn't mean that they are undertaking to solve the problem in less than a noble way. It means they see it differently. So I thought, I can contribute to the esteem in which this institution is to be held by the bench and bar if I can write vigorously, but not in a belittling or personally critical fashion when I dissented. And I found that the court was comprised of six other people who nearly always did exactly that. And so the chemistry of the decisional process of the court was respectful, and it was friendly. It was vigorous, but it wasn't, when there was disagreement, it wasn't, as I said, vitriolic or personal or belittling. in any way